Got all kinds of things up here. The reason is I'm going to try to finish the book of Ezekiel today. Now, we are, as I mentioned last time, we are in the section of Ezekiel where God describes a new temple. And it's really the end of the book. There's a whole section at the end of the book. We had a little bit left to go in the chapter that we left at in 39, I believe it was. So I want to finish that up first. And then we're going to try to finish the book today. And we're going to start in 39. Remember, 39, 38 and 39 was all about Gog and Magog and, you know, Tubal and Meshach and Gomer and Togarma, all these nations. There was this great army from all four points of the compass that was going to attack Jerusalem. And God said, huh. And they were all dead. And there was this vision of this huge, you know, corpses everywhere. They collected, took them 7 months to bury them, all that kind of stuff. Now, right at the end, then God called for a great feast. He told all the animals and the birds to come and feast on the results of the war, the carrion, basically. And we made a point of referencing that's very similar language to what we see in the book of Revelation. Now, 21, verse 21 of chapter 39, is still in the context of this, but he's obviously starting another thought, or it's related anyway. So he just finished. I'm going to back up a little and read. I'll start in verse 18 to get a little context, and I'm going to read on through the end of the chapter. You shall eat the flesh of the mighty, drink the blood of princes of the earth. He's talking to the birds and the beasts. Of rams and lambs, of goats and bulls, all the fatlings of Bashan. You shall eat fat till you are full and drink blood until you are drunk at my sacrificial meal, which I am sacrificing for you. You shall be filled at my table with horses and riders, with mighty men and with all the men of war, says the Lord God. I will set my glory among the nations, and all the nations shall see my judgment, which I have executed, and my hand, which I have laid on them. So the house of Israel shall know that I am the Lord their God from that day forward. The Gentiles shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they were unfaithful to me. Therefore I hid my face from them. I gave them into the hand of their enemies, and they all fell by the sword. According to their uncleanness, and according to the transgressions, I have dealt with them and hidden my face from them. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, now I will bring back the captives of Jacob and have mercy on the whole house of Israel. I will be jealous for my holy name. After they have borne their shame and all their unfaithfulness in which they were unfaithful to me, when they dwelt safely in their own land and no one made them afraid. When I have brought them back from the peoples and gathered them out of the enemy's lands, and I have hallowed in them in the sight of many nations, then they shall know that I am the Lord their God, who sent them into captivity among the nations, but also brought them back to their land and left none of them captive any longer. I will not hide my face from them any more. For I shall have poured out my spirit on the house of Israel, says the Lord God. Now, so we, you know, remember the picture, and really in the whole book of Ezekiel has been focused, at least up and pretty much up until this point, up until the destruction of Jerusalem, on the wickedness of Israel and Judah, and how God was saying, I've got to do it. I've got to destroy Jerusalem. I've got to destroy my temple. I've got to send them all off into captivity, because I've been patient with them and patient with them and patient with them, and they continue to sin and worship idols and just be abominable in my sight. And so this is what I finally have to do. Then he does it, right? Nebuchadnezzar comes down, lays siege to Jerusalem, 586 BC, the city falls. Ezekiel tells us all about this stuff. And then, as soon as that happens, and after Ezekiel gets the word, which it takes about 18 months for him to get the word of it, from a survivor, God starts talking about the future of the people there. He says, I'm going to bring you back. They're saying, we're like a valley full of dry bones. Remember the valley of dry bones? We're like a valley full of dry bones. We're dead. We're cut off. We're worthless. We're gone. We have no hope. Our nation is gone. And God says, I can bring you back. And I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to bring you back. And I'm gonna bring you back to your land. I'm gonna bring you back to safety because you're my people. And I'm gonna do it not because you're righteous, not for your name, but for my own name, for my own great name. And we talked about the whole situation. You remember when God finally destroys Jerusalem through Nebuchadnezzar? Then he goes around to all the countries around and he says, don't think I haven't been watching you. You're sitting here cheering as my people are getting punished, right? And you're saying, ha, look at their God. Look at that God from Jerusalem. He can't do anything. Look how his people are getting whacked around. He says, I'll show you. First of all, I'm going to punish all of you. And then here you can see it. After he says, and even if you brought the biggest army you could imagine, this whole Gog and Magog thing we were talking about last time, even if you brought the biggest army you could imagine from all points of the compass, I could still protect my people. And then he says, now you're going to watch what I've done. You're going to know, the nations will know that I am the Lord. The nations will know that I punished my people and I'm bringing them back. That it isn't a situation that I'm weak or that I'm not real or whatever. I punished them because of their iniquity and their sin. And now that's over, I'm going to bring them back. So, a couple of points here. Notice in 21, I will set my glory among the nations, and all the nations shall see my judgment, which I have executed. He's saying, everyone's going to know who's in control. Then he says, the Gentiles will know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity. Not because of the weakness of their God or whatever, but because of their sin. Because they were unfaithful to me. And he said, therefore, 24, according to their uncleanness and according to the transgressions, I have dealt with them and have hidden my face from them. Then he says, now, verse 25, notice that's a temporal word. Now I will bring them back. It's not something like, you know, it turns out it's about, from this point on, it's about 30 years in the future. But he says, now I will bring them back. It's not thousands of years away. The captives of Jacob, and have mercy on the whole house of Israel. Remember, there used to be two separate kingdoms, Judah and Israel. Israel was wiped out by the Assyrians. God punished them and took them away. They were wicked. They never had a righteous king. Judah finally became so wicked that God had to destroy them with Nebuchadnezzar, with the Babylonians. But now he talks about the whole house of Israel, and we know from our study in Ezekiel and also from the New Testament, like in Romans, that Paul makes it clear that he's talking spiritual Israel here. It's not like all those folks that got wiped out are somehow going to come back and be the nation of Israel again. He's saying there's not going to be a divided nation. I'm going to have one people, spiritual Israel. Now, one little thing here, verse 26. He says, after they have borne their shame and all their unfaithfulness with which they were unfaithful to me, when they dwelt safely in their own land and no one to make them afraid. Now this has a variant translation. Some translations will say afterward they will forget their shame and all their unfaithfulness to me when they dwell safely in their own land and no one makes them afraid. One makes it past tense. One makes it future tense. One says they will bear all of this when they dwelt in safety. In other words, and that's what the New King James reads, and I'll tell you why I think that's the proper one in a minute. But from that perspective, it's saying, do you remember when you dwelt in safety? Do you remember when you had your own nation and you dwelt in safety? Did you honor me? Did you follow me? Were you obedient to me? No. Right? Now, here in that version, in that interpretation of the language there, it's saying, you once were safe and you were wicked. Now I'm going to make you safe again. What are you going to do? It's basically what he's saying. The other way of looking at it is saying that when I make them safe again, they will forget all of this trouble. One, I don't think that's proper because in several places in Ezekiel he says they will always remember and they will be ashamed because of the wickedness that forced me to do this to them. Okay? The other thing, notice down here, let's see. He says this, and then he says, when I have brought them back from the peoples, and I am hallowed in the sight of many, then they shall know that I am the Lord who sent them into captivity. So he's not talking about you're dwelling in the land and you're feeling safe, because he says I haven't even brought you back yet. So I believe what he's saying here is, remember when I was your protector, when Israel was an independent nation and you were protected from all your enemies, what did you do to me? Now I'm about, and I punished you. Now, when I do it again, what are you going to do? Right? You got to be righteous and you got to obey. Okay. Now, that's good. Let's go on to 40. Now, 40 to the end of the book talks about, there are a couple of things I'm going to highlight, but I'm not going to cover it in detail. There's several, there's eight more chapters here. Something like that. What it talks about is Ezekiel is shown a vision, and in this vision, he's shown a temple. And he's shown a temple, and he follows this being around, I'll call him an angel, follows this being around who's got a measuring rod with him, and he's measuring everything. And it's detailed measurements. You can actually build, I did a little drawing here of what this looks like roughly, of the temple he describes. And every single dimension on there is measured and described. It's very detailed. There are chapters of nothing but, and the door to the left of this thing was 3 cubits wide and 6 cubits high, and the thickness of the wall was 0.5 cubit, and the thing next to it was this big and this big and this big and this big, and across from it on the east side you saw this thing, and it's very detailed. It's like an architectural drawing written out in text. Then there is a discussion of how the land's going to be divided up. Again, this is right at the end of the book. And the land is divided up, and it describes it laid out this way between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, these bands from east to west, and it says which tribes are going to get what land and where the temple's going to be. And then it describes the temple. And it says, and we're going to read this is right in the front. He says, God's going to take me in the visions of God, again, to a very high mountain. And to the south of the mountain is a city. So the city's down here. This is a very high mountain. And the entire top of the mountain is dedicated to being the temple of God. And this is this temple that he measures out. And then he says, right towards the end of the book, he says, and there's going to be a river that flows, water that flows out of the east gate of the temple. And it flows down into the valley and eventually into the Dead Sea. And the water gets higher and higher as it flows down. And the water is pure water. And it flows into the Dead Sea, which is a salt sea, right? It's so salty nothing can live in it. And it says it heals it. And there are great multitudes of fishes, like the fish that are in the Mediterranean Sea, in the salt sea. And there are trees on either side of the river. And their fruit, they bear fruit every month. And their leaves are for medicine. That should sound familiar. If you've read Revelation, you see a very similar picture. So there's a lot of stuff in here, but it's really packed into all these chapters talking about the architectural design of the temple. So let's start with 40, and I'm going to read a little bit of it to give you a picture. In the 25th year of our captivity, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was captured, on the very same day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he took me there. In visions of God, he took me unto the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain. On it toward the south was something like the structure of a city. He took me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze. He had a line of flax and a measuring rod in his hand, and he stood in the gateway. And the man said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears and fix your mind on everything I show you. For you were brought here so that I might show them to you. Declare to the house of Israel everything you see. Now there was a wall around the outside of the temple. In the man's hand was a measuring rod, 6 cubits long, each being a cubit and a handbreadth. And he measured the width of the wall structure with one rod, and the height, one rod. Then he went to the gateway, which faced east, and he went up its stairs and measured the threshold of the gateway, which was one rod wide, and the other threshold was one rod wide. Each gate chamber was one rod long and one rod wide. Between the gate chambers was a space of 5 cubits, and the threshold of the gateway, the vestibule of the gate inside, was one rod. He also measured the vestibule on the inside gate, one rod. Then he measured the vestibule of the gateway, 8 cubits, and of the gate posts, 2 cubits. The vestibule of the gate was on the inside. In the eastern gate, there were three gate chambers on one side and three on the other, and three were all the same size. Also, the gateposts were of the same size on this side and on that side. And he measured the width of the entrance of the gateway, 10 cubits, and the width and the length of the gate, 13 cubits. There was a space in front of the gate chambers, 1 cubit on this side and 1 cubit on that side. The gate chambers were 6 cubits on this side and 6 cubits on that side. Then he measured the gateway from the roof of one gate chamber to the roof of another. The width was 25 cubits as door faces door. That's what it does for several chapters. Okay? Now, why? Now this is one of the areas where commentators are all over the place in their understanding of what this is about. First of all, what's the geography he's talking about? Where is he?
On top of a mountain.
He's on top of a mountain. Not just a mountain. You know, we talk about the mountains of Israel, right? If you remember your geography of the area where Jerusalem is located, it is actually located in a mountainous area. Not mountainous as in Rocky Mountains, right? Mountainous as in maybe Appalachians, lower Appalachians. We would probably call them more like foothills.
Usually the New Testament says you go up to Jerusalem or you go down from Jerusalem.
Right, because it was elevated.
Yes.
But it wasn't a very high mountain, and that's what this says. He took me to a very high mountain. A very high mountain. Hold it. There are no very high mountains in that whole area. So the first clue is, he said he was going back to Jerusalem. He's saying, after the city was captured in verse 1, on the very same day, he took me there. So he's saying this is the city of Jerusalem, but now the geography is different. And of course, the geography is real different later when you talk about a river flowing out of the top of this mountain that flows all the way to the Dead Sea and so much water that it freshens the Dead Sea. So this is figurative language, okay? This is not a physical description unless God's going to raise up a really high mountain in the middle of, you know, wherever the new city of Jerusalem is going to be built, because he said the city, something looked like a city. He was up so high, he said to the south was something down there that looked sort of like a city. He was way up. Then, there's this guy standing there, and he's bronze. He's the color of bronze. Remember all those discussions about the various angelic beings, and also the way God is described, like burning metal, like molten metal? That's that description, that same description again. And he says, this guy had a measuring line in his hand and a rod. He had a measuring rod and a line of flax. He's a surveyor. He's going to measure things. How long was the rod?
6 cubits.
6 cubits. Each being a cubit and a hand breadth. And he measured the width of the wall structure. So now, a little bit about, remember we talked about some of this before. A cubit is the distance from your elbow to your finger. Okay? Now, a cubit and a hand breadth is like that. So it's a long cubit. Now, of course, the problem with measuring in cubits is sort of like the problem of measuring with feet. My cubit is a lot longer than your cubit. Right? But this is how they measured. So roughly, there's two different schools of thought. A cubit that he's talking about here is either 24 inches or 21 inches, but it's roughly close to 2 feet. Okay, I use 21 inches in my calculations. And he has 6 of those. So a rod of 6 of those is about 10 feet tall, maybe 11. Okay, and then he has a string that he's going to be measuring with. That's measured out. So he's like a surveyor. And he's going around with his rod measuring stuff, you know, and telling Ezekiel. And what does he say? He says, Ezekiel, you've been brought here. Pay attention to everything you see and everything you hear and tell it to the people of Israel. So this isn't just, you know, I'm laying down some plans here. The builders will get it in, you know, in 50 years and they're supposed to rebuild the temple. This is no. Everybody is to know this. So why? Good question. Now, what do we know about the temple, this description? If you go through it, and I've been through it several times, a couple times I just listened to it and tried to visualize it in my head, let it draw the design as I was doing it. This is basically what you have. It's 4 square. You've got this area, you've got the Holy of Holies here inside a building, you've got the holy place in front of the building. This is the temple, this is the kind of holy place of the temple proper. You've got a big altar out here. You've got these gateways coming into it. You've got these other gateways. All that stuff about all the rooms along, every one of these gateways are several different rooms, and people would be seated in those rooms is kind of the anticipation. The other thing that you have in here, which we're not going to read directly because it's a long section, is there's all kinds of rooms and places and tables and hooks and things like that for animal sacrifices. It says, here's the place that they boil the sacrifices. Here's the place that they prepare the sacrifices. And it says, there are hooks along the wall. You know what they're doing? You've seen pictures of the meat market, right? They're hanging up the animals. You know, so they can skin them and stuff before they cook them or whatever. And there's all this discussion about what the priests do, which of these are rooms everywhere, which room, you know, which priests go in what room, what their purposes are. There's a whole discussion of the festivals that are going to be kept here. There's a whole discussion of the priests and how what they have to wear. It says they should never wear anything wool. They should only wear linen, anything that causes them to sweat. There's some really detailed discussions of worship in the temple, of the structure and preparation of the sacrifices of the temple. It reads, frankly, it reads a lot like Numbers and Leviticus. You know, it reads like the description of the tabernacle and the temple in those books. Why? Now, a couple of things we know for sure. The geography is different. This isn't physical Israel, unless God's going to make a mountain there. And two, what do we know because the temple has specific instructions for animal sacrifices? What does it tell us? It ain't heaven. Because what do we know about heaven? How many sacrifices go on in heaven?
None.
Well, only one did. Yes. Only one. Once for all, Hebrews says. What was sacrificed in heaven?
Jesus.
The Holy Lamb of God. In fact, in the book of Revelation, he's described as a lamb as if it had been slain or butchered or slaughtered. Okay? One lamb, one sacrifice, one time, done. Once for all. So there's no continual sacrifices. I mean, there are instructions here in this section of Ezekiel that talk about how many sacrifices have to happen every day, in the morning, in the evening. You know, it sounds a lot like the older parts of the Old Testament. It also says that the altar, when it is made, has to be atoned for. So there are certain sacrifices you have to do to make atonement for the altar, to make it holy. It can't be the one in heaven, right? Because nothing's unholy in heaven. So you know a few things. You know this isn't physical Jerusalem, and you know that this isn't the temple in heaven. So you might ask the question, well, they did rebuild the temple, right? When they came back from captivity, they did rebuild the temple. I mean, Jesus was in the temple 400 years later. So did they rebuild the temple? Yeah, they rebuilt the temple. Okay, actually it's like 600 years later for Jesus. Was it the same temple? The answer is no. This temple is way bigger than the temple that was built. In fact, you remember when they brought him back and they did rebuild the temple after the captivity? God said, get the people, get the men who were alive and saw the old temple. They were really old men by this because they've been in captivity for 70 years. And what did they do? They wept when they saw the temple because it was nothing like the original temple. So, this isn't the physical temple that was built. It's got all kinds of details about animal sacrifices or about the law of Moses, which couldn't survive the cross, right? So why is it there? The other thing to look at is this situation. So right at the end of the book, or close to the end of the book, it says, and here's how the land is going to be divided. Now remember all that discussion about there's not going to be two kingdoms anymore? Let's back into our history a little bit. The two kingdoms were what? Israel and Judah, north and south. The kingdom of Judah were which tribes? The first one ought to be easy.
Judah.
And
Benjamin.
And
half tribe of I don't remember.
Part of the half tribe of Manasseh. And a few others. And it wasn't like there was nobody from Reuben and Dan, right? There were people there who were from all the different tribes. But the tribes as a whole were all north. Up in Israel, also called Ephraim in the scripture, you had Ephraim, the other half of Manasseh, and all the rest of the tribes. 10 of them, right? Notice what we have here. Dan, Asher, Nephilim, Manasseh, Ephraim, Reuben, Judah, Levi, Benjamin, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun, and Gad. All 12. What do you see different? Ephraim and Manasseh. Remember, they were the sons of Joseph. This is one of the questions we had in our kids' class the other day. How many tribes were there? Well, here they're given separate spaces. But this is laid out. Remember when they came into the land, when Joshua took the land and they gave away pieces of the land to all the tribes? They got pieces of the land. What's interesting about this is how it's laid out. Now, if you've ever seen a map of Israel and the way the tribes all got their land, it was a patchwork, right? It looked like a jigsaw puzzle. But here, this says, your eastern border will be the Jordan River. The western border will be the Salt Sea. That's the Mediterranean Sea, the Great Sea. The north border and the south border are described originally in Numbers. And then it says, the land is going to be for Dan from east to west, and Asher from east to west. It's basically a bunch of horizontal stripes, which isn't the way it was laid out originally. Nowhere close. So what you have here, for one, notice it's very geometric and rectangular, right? Look at that temple over there. Very geometric and rectangular. This is idealized. This is an ideal picture. So what is it telling us? It's not a physical picture. The land was never given back in this form. These pieces of land were never assigned to tribes when they came back. Ever. Okay? And they're not there today. And so what do you know? The remnant is going to be, didn't God just say, I'm going to bring back all the whole house of Israel, all the captives, all the remnant? Yeah. Are they all going to have a place in my land? Yeah. Are there going to be equal places in my land? Yeah. You see what it's saying? It's figurative language. It's not literal. Now, there are folks, especially the premillennial camp, who want to believe in the rapture and Armageddon and a whole bunch of things and make all this stuff very literal. And they say, this is literally going to happen. There's going to be a great earthquake, great volcano or something, and a great mountain is going to rise up in Israel. That this physical temple has to be rebuilt. That the land is actually going to be divided up exactly this way. Okay? And that the inhabitants of the tribes, who can prove their lineage, and one of the problems with going off into captivity for hundreds of years, is they lost track of who belonged to whom. They couldn't prove it. Once, of course, they could by the time when they came back from captivity, they could, but today, after the dispersion, they can't really. So you got all this stuff here, and they say, oh, well, all this has to happen. This is going to be the physical temple. Then they got a big problem over here in the temple. They say this is going to happen. This is when the kingdom is established in the millennium. You know, this is why they're premillennialists. They believe there's going to be a millennial reign of Christ on earth and a physical temple in Jerusalem for 1,000 years. If Jesus is on the throne in this 1,000-year reign, why in the world are there bloody animal sacrifices going on in the temple in Jerusalem? Makes no sense at all.
If you start with a false premise, you end with a false conclusion.
Yes. And this is one of those things, and if you read, I have a great commentary on Ezekiel that has a lot of collections of those, what the various groups say, and they're all over the place on this. Because basically, they ran into a brick wall with their doctrine. An absolute brick wall. This cannot be the temple, physical temple in Jerusalem of the millennium, because there are bloody animal sacrifices there. They even try to argue that, well, the Christian age doesn't have animal sacrifices, but in the future, in the millennium, there can be Christ with the sacrifices for sin and all the animal sacrifices, so the Jews will be happy, all the righteous Jews that are brought back to life. I mean, there's some really strange explanations they try to put in to make that work. It just doesn't work. Now, so, one, this is figurative language. How many times have we seen figurative language in the book of Ezekiel? About every chapter. So it shouldn't surprise us. What is it saying? What did God just say? He said, do you remember when I used to have you in your land and you had a temple and you were safe? Remember how you treated me? Let me tell you about the new land and the new temple and my expectations for how you're going to treat me. This is what the message is. The new temple is greater and more perfect than the old temple. The land is ideal and laid out very geometrically, very, very precise. And my expectations for my people is holiness. Holiness. No more will you defile it with idols. And later on he says, no more will you defile you will defile my country with the corpses of your kings on the high places. You remember the high places? That's where all the idolatrous worship was? Or at least until they brought it all down to Jerusalem. And the kings were killed there. Okay. Now, there are chapters after chapters after chapters of very detailed descriptions. The chambers of the priests, the outer dimensions of the temple. Let's skip ahead to chapter 43. Chapter 43, verse 10. Well, let me back up a little bit. Verse 1. We see a very significant happening here. See if you pick it up. Afterward, he brought me to the gate that faces toward the east, and behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. His voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. It was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I saw when I came to destroy the city. The visions were like the vision which I saw by the river Kibar. And I fell on my face, and the glory of the Lord came into the temple by the way of the gate which faces toward the east. The Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. Then I heard him speaking to me from the temple while a man stood beside me, and he said to me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne, and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever. No more shall the house of Israel defile my holy name, nor their kings by their harlotry or their carcasses of their kings on their high places. When they set their threshold by my threshold and their doorpost by my doorpost with a wall between them and me, they defiled my holy name by their abominations which they committed. Therefore I have consumed them in my anger. Now let them put away their harlotry and the carcasses of their kings far away from me, and I will dwell in their midst forever. Son of man, describe the temple to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the pattern. And if they are ashamed of all that they have done, make known to them the design of the temple and its arrangement, its exits and its entrances, its entire design and all its ordinances, all its forms and all its laws. Write it down in their sight so that they may keep its whole design and all its ordinances and perform them. This is the law of the temple. The whole area surrounding the mountaintop is most holy. Behold, this is the law of the temple. And then he starts back in, the measurements of the altar are so many cubits this way and that way. What did you hear happen there? What was the event that happened? Let me remind you. Do you remember early in Ezekiel? God, it says, the Spirit snatched me up by the hair of my head and took me to Jerusalem and set me down in the temple and showed all the wickedness that was going on. You remember all those things? The women weaving for Tammuz, the elders with all their detestable things, the men, probably the priests standing with their backs to the holy place, worshiping the sun as it came up, all those abominations. And then God says, he calls for six men who come with slaughter weapons, and they're going to go destroy. And God says, hold it, and he sends a man among the people to mark those who sigh and cry for the sin and wickedness, remember? Do you remember what happened before that? It said God's Spirit and His glory left the temple. The Shekinah is what it is in Hebrew. God removed His glory from the temple that had been there since Solomon had dedicated it. And now it's gone. Here it comes back. That's the big event. The big event. This new temple is dedicated. Remember, this is figurative language. And remember, it's the whole mountaintop is most holy. None of that like that existed in Jerusalem. Still doesn't. And God brings His Spirit there and He says, by the way, what was the purpose of the first temple? What did God say it was for? What dwelt in the temple? No, actually, God said, it is a dwelling place for my name. It's a dwelling place for my name. Just His name. What does he say now is in the temple? My throne? The dwelling where my feet will be? And where I will dwell forever? That's a different picture, isn't it? Than just a place for your name to hang out. So again, very figurative language, but notice what he's telling them. This is going to be where I dwell. Now, verse 10, Son of man, describe the temple to the house of Israel that they may be ashamed for their iniquities. There's the purpose right there. It says, describe, and he says, and when they're ashamed, make known to them the design of the temple and its arrangements, its exits and entrances, the entire design and all its ordinances, all its forms, and all its laws. There's the purpose for this section of Ezekiel. Notice, they are to keep its whole design. Now you could say keep a design might mean to build it exactly to the design, right? I don't think that's what it's saying. Keep it. There are lessons being taught here in this design. Keep them. What is it? Holiness. Holiness. You know that little piece where he said, you defiled my sanctuary when you built your house right next to mine, and your doorpost touched my doorpost, and your wall was in between me? You know what that's saying? By the way, this area has a big gap around it. It's isolated. He says, you make no difference between the holy and the common. My temple is holy, and I am holy. And you don't just build your house right next to mine. You make me separate. That's what holy means. Be separate. And sanctify me, separate me as holy. So, notice what he says. The purpose, describe it, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities. Why would this make them ashamed of their iniquities? Why would this drawing of the temple make them ashamed? Well, first of all, this is way more perfect and glorious than any temple that was built before or after. And two, all the behavior that's going on in this temple bespeaks of a nation totally dedicated and faithful to God. And so they're going to be ashamed because they know they're not. And they haven't been. Now, see if I can get through the rest of this. I only got a few minutes. And I got to log back in. Okay. And notice he says in verse 12, this is the law of the temple. The whole area surrounding the mountaintop is most holy. Behold, this is the law of the temple. This is not a minor discussion. When God declares law, you better listen. You better do what he says. Now, let me jump a couple chapters. There's a whole bunch of discussion about what the prince is allowed to do. The east gate of the temple, by the way, faces the sun, and it's holy. It's so holy that once the Spirit of God comes in the gate, no one is allowed to come into the gate. Except the prince, and only on certain very special days. It's a very holy place. Now, let's jump to... It's a whole discussion here about worship, which is all about burnt offerings and how they're prepared. 47. Then he brought me back to the door of the temple, and there was water flowing from under the threshold of the temple toward the east. So this would be out the front door of the temple. For the front of the temple faced east, and the water was flowing from under the right side of the temple south of the altar. He brought me out by the way of the north gate, and led me around the outside to the outer gateway that faces east, and there was water running out on the right side. And when the man went to the east with a line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits. And he brought me through the waters, and the water came up to my ankles. And then he measured 1,000 and brought me to the waters, and the water came up to my knees. And he measured 1,000 and brought me through, and the water came up to my waist. And he measured 1,000, and it was a river I could not cross, for the water was too deep. And the water in which one must swim, a river that could not be crossed. And he said to me, Son of man, have you seen this? Then he brought me and returned me to the bank of the river. When I returned there along the bank of the river, there were many trees on one side or the other. And he said to me, this water flows toward the eastern region, goes down into the valley and enters the sea. When it enters the sea, its waters are healed. And it shall be that every living thing that moves wherever the rivers go will live. There will be a great multitude of fish because these waters go there, for they will be healed. And everything will live wherever the water goes. It shall be that fishermen will stand by it from En-Gedi to En-Eglaim, and they will be places for spreading nets. Their fish will be of the same kinds as the fish of the great sea, exceedingly many. But its swamps and marshes will not be healed. They will be given over to salt. Along the banks of the river, on this side and that, will grow all kinds of trees used for fruit, food. Their leaves will not wither, and their fruit will not fail. And they will bear fruit every month, because their water flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for medicine. First thing, imagine this river for a second. First of all, I didn't take time to calculate it or even guess at it, but we're talking a serious volume of water coming out here. This isn't a little trickle. But think of the geography for a second. This is on a mountain, so it's going down the slopes of a mountain. He said the first 1,000 cubits, okay, roughly 2,000 feet, half a mile, roughly, it's up to the ankles. But it's going downhill, right? And then the next 1,000 feet, it's up to the knees. The next 1,000 feet, it's up to the waist. We're still going downhill. Now, if you play with your physics there, that's not possible. Because the amount of water is not going to pile up going downhill, right? It's just going to go faster downhill. This is figurative speech. This is figurative speech. Water coming down, a huge river growing, growing and growing, flows down into the valley and down to the Salt Sea, which is the Dead Sea, and heals the waters. In other words, dilutes the salt until all the fish that live in the Great Sea, the Mediterranean, can live there. Which means what? It's gone from being so salty that nothing can inhabit to the perfect salinity of the ocean, which critters love. Which, by the way, is the same salinity of our blood. And so all of a sudden you've got, you know, what was En-Gedi and En-Eglaim, the southern part of the valley around the Dead Sea, all of a sudden this is a sea so full of fish that it's just so abundant. People are fishing everywhere, and then he goes back to the head of the water, and there's all these forests of trees with all this fruit. And the leaves never wither, and the fruit never fails. It's going on forever. And it says, everywhere the water touches is healed, and everything springs to life because it came out of the sanctuary. That's not just H2O, folks. Why is it special because it came out of the sanctuary? Jesus once said this.
It's blessed and
clean.
It's blessed and clean.
It's blessed. It's holy. It's the water of life. The water of life. You get the same picture in the book of Revelation, okay, about the river of water of life. Everything it touches springs to life and doesn't fail, doesn't wither, and becomes healthy and whole. Except for the marshes, it says, they're given over to salt. Well, the people still needed salt. They needed a place where they could basically dam off the water. They do it today. You go to places where there's, they do it in India. They dam off part of the sea, marsh, and they let it dry out, and the salt crystallizes, and they scrape up the salt, and they use the salt. Okay, so, got to finish here. Chapter 49. This whole long discussion of the division of the land, and then you have verse 30. These are the exits of the city. On the north side, measuring 4,500 cubits, the gates of the city shall be named for the tribes of Israel. Three gates northward, one for Reuben, one for Judah, one for Levi. On the east side, 4,500 cubits, three gates, one for Joseph, one for Benjamin, one for Dan. On the south side, 4,500 cubits, three gates, one for Simeon, one for Issachar, one for Zebulun. On the west side, 4,500 cubits, and there are three gates, one for Gad, one for Asher, one for Naphtali. All the way around shall be 18,000 cubits. And the name of the city from that day will be, The Lord is There. The Lord is There. What was the name of Jerusalem before it was called Jerusalem? Great Old Testament trivia question. It was a place called Luz. which means light. Jerusalem means the city of peace, Salem, at the end. But now it's called the Lord is there. Is there. Not the name of the Lord. The Lord is there. He said, this is the soul, where the soles of my feet. This is my throne. This is where I'm hanging out. The Lord is there. And he describes this place for, and you know, we don't use furlongs, so it's kind of hard to figure out, or cubits. We don't use furlongs either, which are used in Revelation. But that's basically 1.5 miles on a side that he just described. The city, 1.5 miles on a side. That's not very big. Rutherfordton's quite a bit bigger than that. Okay?
One here says about 6 miles.
6 square miles? Yeah. It depends on how you want to calculate how long. If you use the longer cubit, it's a little bigger. But the point is, it's relatively small. In Revelation, where it talks about the New Jerusalem, it measures it 12,000 furlongs. Long, wide, and high. It's a cube. 12,000 furlongs is 1,500 miles. 1,000 times longer in every dimension than the city talked about here. 1 billion times more spacious. Literally 1 billion. 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000. What's fascinating about this, as we finish up, is he figuratively talking to Jews. And what is he saying? You're going to get your land back, and it's going to be perfectly allocated. You're going to get your temple back, and it will be perfect in all of its function. You're going to get your city back, and it will be all the tribes will be there. There's, you know, a gate for each tribe. It's going to be a place of safety. But you know what's said over and over in these chapters? Two letters. I-F. If. If you're ashamed of your iniquities. If you obey. If you keep me holy. If. We see that same thing in the New Testament. Okay. That's it for Ezekiel. I'm not going to be here next Sunday. We'll have a fill-in. And after that, we start in the book of Daniel. So if you want to start reading, you can just flip a page and start reading Daniel. Thank you.